This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. In the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which is out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg, is a story about how we are living from data point to data point, careening between glee and gloom as a result. That is our life in a nutshell.
Yeah, I can think of no better sort of descriptor for the last 24 hours. On the one hand, we have some news from JP Morgan. On the other hand, you know, we get the hottest inflation since 1981. Rich Miller writes all about it, economics reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So Joel, let's start with that, the last 24 hours, the highest inflation reading in since 1981. And then Jamie Dimon this morning saying that the consumer right now is in great shape. So even if we go into a recession, they're entering that recession with less leverage and in far better shape than they did in 08 and 09.
You got whiplash yet?
Yeah, I do.
Yes, totally.
We were talking about this story. I was like, what are you supposed to think? I don't know, but whiplash is a thing for sure. I just long for the days of, last year when things only went up. That was great, right? Everything went up except inflation, and now only inflation goes up. That was basically what we turned to Rich and said, you know, wow, we're feeling some whiplash, Rich. And so how much whiplash did we give you working on this story?
Well, I mean, we had some good editors, so it didn't get much whiplash. But the story has a great graphic on it, which we graphed all these different indicators, and it's like spaghetti. Some of it's going up, some of it's going down. You got red, you got blue, you got purple. It just shows how confusing things are. I mean, the biggest confusion, at least on the economics front, is it looks like there's a chance that gross domestic product, which is kind of the measure of the overall economy, may have sunk in the first two quarters of this year. And, you know, back of the envelope, that everybody goes, wow, that screams recession. Meanwhile, you got, you know, employers adding about like 2 million workers during the first 2.7 million workers during the first half. So you're scratching your heads. We're producing less, but we've got 2.7 million workers. What's going on here?
How does this work? Like, I don't get it. Wait, we're all talking recession yet. Man, this is a really tight labor market. You know, the big problem is, right, inflation. And even though the Fed's being aggressive, it is still persistently high. And we're all wondering, like, how quickly can it come down after we've all been saying, oh, it'll be next month. No, it'll be next month. And that hasn't happened.
Yeah. I mean, and the policymakers are, you know, as befuddled as everybody else, basically. You know, we've got a quote in there from none other than Jay Powell, where he says, you know, I think we understand better how little we understand about inflation. So, Yeah, I mean, this has surprised everyone, and the late, as you guys were just saying, the latest numbers were a scorcher, and the Fed folks said we were bracing for a bad one, but this was even worse than we thought. And that's the big question going forward. How is the economy slows? Because it looks like the economy is slowing. What's going to happen with this inflation rate?
But in a sense, Rich, and I'm trying to just view this from an optimistic standpoint, doesn't that leave the Fed's job kind of more in the clear? If the employment, if employment in this economy is so strong and inflation is still so high, it does give the Fed the breathing room to do stuff like 75 basis points or even gasp, 100 basis points rate hikes, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like everything, and sort of like the story, it's, and I hate to be like sound like the two-handed economist, though I'm not an economist, on the one hand, on the other. on the one hand, you're right. Yeah. I mean, but on the other hand, they're trying to get inflation down. And if the jobs markets are tight and people are getting wage increases, even though they're not keeping up with inflation, but if people are getting wage increases of 5 to 6% a year, companies are going to feel like, wow, geez, I got to raise my prices 5 or 6% a year just to keep up with it. So it's kind of a two-edged sword, I mean, and they're trying to sort of, thread the needle here. Somebody said to me they're trying to thread the needle wearing oven mitts while they're sitting in the dark. I mean, it's not exactly an easy task.
It's impossible.
Okay, so that might mean that there's some more whiplash to come, Rich. So what are the next, data points and signals that you and others are going to be watching to
We got some tomorrow, actually. There's going to be two sort of important ones, two of the more important ones before the Fed officials stop talking one publicly about 1 week before they go into what they call a dark period, about 1 week before they meet. So that dark period starting Friday. But before they do that, we got two big ones. There's retail sales. So there's been some signs that consumers are pulling back a little, though you can't necessarily tell that if you go to the airport. But there are some signs of consumers pulling back a bit, and so that retail sales number is going to be big. And then we got something called the University of Michigan household survey, and they asked people, well, what do you think inflation is going to be 3 to 5 years from now? And the Fed watches that like a hawk. In fact, if that's going up, and it sort of tentatively went up last time, that was the reason they went 75 basis points last time. So, I mean, if that went up a lot, maybe that would tip them to this 100 basis points that people are sort of chattering about now.
That's what happened last time.
Well,
yep, exactly.
We've talked so much about the importance of sentiment, right? We know the Fed is watching this very closely because sentiment can become very quickly reality, whether it's how consumers spend or what investors invest or not invest.
Right. Yeah, it's like, it's like the whole self-fulfilling prophecy, right? There's a couple of different ways it works, but one, you remember during the early parts of COVID, we all thought we were going to run out of toilet paper, right? Everybody runs to the store and buys toilet paper, and lo and behold, there's no toilet paper left, right? But I've got like 15 rolls at home, right? So, and everybody else does too. If everybody thinks inflation is going to be really taking off, people will start, buying ahead of time, and that pushes inflation up. So you sort of, you can talk yourself into higher inflation.
Hey, Rich, before we let you go, we got 30 seconds left.
Sure.
For our investing audience, what do they need to expect when it comes to whiplash here? What do they need to know?
Strap yourself in?
Yes, right. Strap yourself in. Watch the VIX, because that's probably going to
tell you
what's going on. Point.
Remember that barf bag on the cover a couple weeks ago? There you go.
Right.
The vomit comet.
Oh, my God.
That's what this market is.
Such a perfect story for where we've been and where we're still going. Rich Miller, economics reporter at Bloomberg News. This is the remarks this week, right, Joe?
Yep.
All right. Good stuff. Rich joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. And, of course, Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week here in our Interactive Broker Studio. I'm just curious how many times, was he working on the story, then the headline changed, good news.
Or new data. Every day there's more data.
Amazingly, this was the assignment, and then could it get more perfect? Yeah.
God, it just makes so much sense. All right. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Check out the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course, always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Check out our weekend show as well come Saturday.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
well, new COVID boosters are coming. Who's going to take them? We just talked about that. And it's a subject of a Bloomberg Opinion columnist today, which makes you wonder, you know, if any of this is going to change now that the White House is said to be considering making second booster shots widely available for all adults. Will people step up and take them, Tim?
Well, that's the question. And is it too late to have these formulations of boosters that don't necessarily tackle the Omicron variant?
Right?
That's my big question for Dr. David Dowdy, infectious disease epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Dowdy, good to have you with us. That's exactly where I want to start. Are these boosters worth it for people under the age of 50, given that the BA4 and BA5 subvariants are not necessarily targeted in these current iterations?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me. You know, I would say on balance, the benefits of vaccination do outweigh the risks, including of these second boosters. But is it a high priority? I think, now for reasons that you're just saying, I think it's hard to say that's true.
It's hard to say what's true.
It's hard to say that this should be our utmost priority.
Interesting.
So a couple of things going on. First of all, most of the hospitalizations we're seeing are in older adults. And so we're talking about people who are already eligible for that that second booster. And then secondly, as you're saying, BA4, BA5 are now the dominant subvariants. While our vaccinations do provide good protection against serious disease, they don't really protect against infection against these subvariants well at all. So I'm not sure exactly what we're hoping to get out of another booster wave in advance of hopefully bivalent vaccines will be coming down that will target these subvariants.
I look no further than across the table to Carol, who has recovered from her second bout of COVID in just a couple of months. And I imagine, Carol, that
in a month,
BA4 or in 1 month, that's right. And it was BA4 or BA5, and you're boosted.
I'm boosted. You're I'm double vaxxed and double boosted. Yeah, I'm looking for guidance. Like, I'm thinking a lot. Tim and I, Dr. Dowdy, think a lot about the fall when it starts to cool off. We're back inside again. Nobody wants to wear masks anymore. Like, what is it that you think we're going to really need to protect us from this next wave, whatever that might be?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that honestly, we are already in the middle of a wave. best estimates of how much transmission is going on right now is that it's higher than it's ever been before, except for this past winter. So it's not like we really can go a whole lot higher this coming fall and winter. As just discussed, we are hoping to have newer vaccines coming out in the coming months. So, you know, I'm not sure that things are going to get much worse over the winter, but our vaccines should get better.
You know? What about when it comes to kids? We have a kid under the age of 5 who is not yet vaccinated. He was set to get vaccinated, but then he got COVID, so the doctor said, hold off on getting him vaccinated. Do I want to wait to see if he can get a shot that is targeted specifically to these variants? Or given the way that we see development for these vaccines, is that going to just take too long?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I think I want to make sure that nothing in this discussion comes off as saying vaccines don't work, right? All these vaccines do work, and for people who are eligible for these vaccines, I would recommend getting the recommended series. And it's also hard to know, especially for young kids, how quickly some of these newer formulations are going to become available.
Yeah.
And where we're going to be in the pandemic 6 or 12 months from now. I mean, we may be talking about BA 10 or 11 by that time.
Well, that's what I want. How do you think about the variants and kind of where they're going? We have a great story from Business Week by O'Reilly Griffin, and we talked about it, and it's going to be in our weekend show, and it's about this startup that is tapping AI to predict the COVID variants and try and get ahead of where these variants are going and then hopefully have the right treatments that we need so that there isn't this lag. How do you think about variants and how they mutate?
Well, I mean, I think that mutation is what viruses do. And we know that this is going to happen. And just because viruses mutate doesn't mean that they are forever getting worse and worse and more dangerous. Right? We can always compare the current variant to the one before and say that the current variant has an advantage because it's got something new that our immune systems haven't seen before. Doesn't mean that the current variant is worse or scarier. It just means that it's found a way to evade our current immune system. But this is what we expect. And, I think we should be expecting for months and years to come. We're going to be seeing new variants and new subvariants. But if we're not seeing deaths go up, if we're not seeing hospitalizations go up, that's not something that we need to be concerning ourselves about.
Dr. Dowdy, just got about 30, 40 seconds here. So Tim, as I say, you've got a bullet on your back, or you've got a, a bullseye on your back, because Tim has not had COVID yet.
Knock on wood.
I went 26 months, didn't have it, or I don't know, I might have had it back in February 2020. Who knows at that point? But I've just had a back-to-back. Do I have a higher immunity, or is Tim like some super immunity? And again, just got about 30 seconds.
Both can be true, Carol.
Yeah.
You probably do have higher immunity.
Yes.
My guess is Tim, it is coming for you at some point. I just had my first case last week, so it happens to the best of us.
All right. The trick to avoiding COVID is not to plan a vacation. If you plan a vacation, then you're going to get it. So,
well said. Well said, Dr. Dowdy. Thank you so much. You covered a lot of ground and stuff we were hoping to get to. Dr. David Dowdy, infectious disease epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the school founder, of course, Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Carol Masser, Tim Stanovic. I've got super immunity, Tim.
It's coming for me.
You better watch out. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stanovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Charlie mentioned the trade that we're seeing in some of the big banks. Morgan Stanley way off its lows. It was down as much as 4%, now just down 0.3%. Charlie mentioned JP Morgan was down more than 5% at its lows, still down about 3.7%. We heard a lot from these CEOs.
Yeah, I want to start with JP Morgan. Hannah's story about JP Morgan halting share buybacks, his earnings missed estimates. Hannah Levitt is finance reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Hannah, what do we need to know? We'll get to Morgan Stanley in just a minute. What do we need to know about JP Morgan's results?
Hey, thank you guys for having me. So as you mentioned, JP Morgan suspended their share buybacks, and that was to quickly meet higher capital requirements and also to stay flexible in preparation for a range of economic outcomes. So you can kind of separate that into two pieces. And, you know, one of them is the more wonky, like stress test capital related thing that we don't need to get into. But in preparation for a range of economic environments really hits on, you know, the hurricane comments that we heard from Jamie last month. And so, you know, if you look elsewhere in the firm, they built their reserves for potentially soured loans a bit, and that was more than analysts were expecting, and they described a modest worsening of their economic outlook. But at the same time, they, described a healthy U.S. economy right now. So it's kind of an interesting, everything's good now, but maybe not later.
It's like a cruise line buffet, right? There's a little something for everybody out there.
Well, or it's fine now, but not good later? I don't know.
Well, that's what, Hannah, we have been so looking forward to this, because it's like these folks, especially Jamie Dimon, what he has to say, right? It carries a lot when it comes to what's going on, not just in the U.S. economy, but global economy. Was there a takeaway for you from it?
I think really just that Jamie and Jeremy Barnum, the CFO, were citing things like consumer spending being good and the job market, and all of these things that create, you know, the reason why they're not, you know, seeing losses tick up or anything like that. So the quarter, as far as that goes, actually looked good, and they talked a lot about that. But then there are all these issues that we're, you know, well aware of at this point, like high inflation, like Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and other geopolitical events that, you know, are likely to lead to negative consequences down the road. And, you know, in some cases have led to negative consequences and are driving a ton of volatility, which we've been seeing for months now.
I wouldn't say I was surprised, but I mean, one thing that really sticks out to me are his comments about how strong the American consumer is. because it also dovetails with what we heard from James Gorman at Morgan Stanley. So Jamie Dimon saying, quote, the consumer right now is in great shape. So even if we go into a recession, they're entering that recession with less leverage and in far better shape than they did in 08 and 09. I'm wondering how you would characterize his comments, given that what is that weatherman that you mentioned from last month. And it kind of seems like, not that he's walking those comments back, but it's more of a glasses mm-hmm. half full approach today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to answer your question, I'll go to one of James Gorman and Morgan Stanley's comments, which is that he doesn't expect a severe recession. And he noted that, you know, the economic environment is complicated, but it's not 2008 complicated. So, you know, if you just look at the consumer, that there was much more leverage at that time than there is now. So that was, I think, part of what Jamie and what James Gorman were talking about.
You know, all big banks not equal when it comes to M&A, trading, and different things. Where did JPM stand out in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly? Where did Morgan Stanley stand out when it comes to the good, the bad, and the ugly? I know Morgan Stanley took a big hit when it comes to M&A. It's not been a great year when it comes to that overall.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, JPMorgan is a lot bigger than Morgan Stanley, of course. So the things that they had in common was that they both saw good trading results and bad investment banking results. And those are really two sides of the same coin when you think about this quarter. It's like there's a lot of volatility, so there's a lot of trading, so trading revenue goes up. But at the same time, there's a lot of volatility, so people stay on the sidelines for things like M&A and equity and debt issuance. So that was a major theme that ran through both of them. You know, at JP Morgan, we saw higher net interest income, and we'll continue to see that. They actually raised their guidance for the full year. And that's really driven by the Fed's rate hike. So that'll be something that we continue to see. And I think Gorman said, mentioned something about that, although Morgan Stanley is much less reliant on that than JP Morgan is. And, you know, there'll be more tomorrow. Citigroup and Wells Fargo are up tomorrow, and we'll get to see even more about this.
Yeah, curious about what Wells Fargo has to say about, certainly when it comes to mortgages and the consumer side of things.
Well, if you have any questions, Carol, just ask Hannah, because she also covers Wells Fargo. So I know she'll be watching those very closely.
Hope you're eating your Wheaties, girl, because you're going to be busy. Hannah Levitt, thank you so much. Finance reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from New York City. But these tidbits are really helpful. And, you know, we kind of rely on sort of the economic data points, what Fed officials have to say, but what these, especially big banks who see things globally, what they have to say.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So we mentioned earlier JP Morgan halting share buybacks as earnings missed estimates. You also had the CEO, Jamie Dimon, saying the firm is preparing for a range of economic environments. And then, Tim, you had Morgan Stanley. They did have a surge in fixed income revenue, but it wasn't enough to really make up for a big investment banking revenue miss. But I will say, Morgan Stanley in particular, that stock is little changed and has really recouped.
Am I going to have to give it away? It's no longer a decliner? Or is it still a decliner?
It's down 0.7%.
All right. So I might have to revisit that. Hey, speaking of revisiting, we love revisiting with Anton Schutz, president and CIO at Mendon Capital Advisors. Anton joins us on the phone from Florida. We like to talk to you whenever we are doing big bank earnings or regional bank earnings as well. Anton, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How about yourself?
We're doing pretty well. So we're kicking off earnings season. We got Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan. Just give us your reaction now that we've had a few hours to digest these results.
Sure. First of all, start with JP Morgan. I think Jamie walked back his hurricane comments. So I think that started a pretty big sell-off a couple weeks ago. At the end of the day, you know, they got a little too aggressive with their buyback earlier, right? They had a little too many risk-weighted assets. The big banks have to carry more capital, right? They're systemically important, and they've got some new numbers that they've got to live up to, so they've got to build capital. I don't think it's a surprise to people who follow the stock that there were no more buybacks. I think the announcement just kind of shook some people who weren't paying attention to it. And that's a tale of two cities, because, you know, you look at Morgan Stanley, where the CEO said, hey, we like our stock at 72. We're happy we have the ability to buy back stock, and they still have plenty of excess capital to be able to do it. Both quarters were ho-hum, right? I mean, there's nothing crazy standing out. I think what stands out is the stocks are substantially off their highs. And, you know, what every walk of financial is now trading at single-digit forward earnings. And, you know, the prospects appear fine. Everybody's predicting 2007. And I will tell you, in 2007, I ran money back then. And I sure saw it coming, you know, in the financial system. It's a lot of bad practices. It's a lot of bad bank management. a lot of bad products. I'm just not seeing that. I mean, and you know what? Banks are only 20% of lending today. There's so many other external forces on the lending side. I do not think banks are the problem children here if we have a recession.
So help me, big banks versus regionals. I looked at the Spider S&P Regional Bank ETF. It's down about 18% so far this year. If you look at the KBW Bank Index, which is, as you know, Anton, you know, the big money center banks, also the regionals, it's down about 25-26% so far this year. You have always liked the regional space and you play in there and you, you know, invest in that space. You know, what are you thinking about the environment of regionals versus the big money centers?
Well, first of all, they're not quite as capital constrained. I think that's important. You know, the regulators, you know, are all over the big banks, and, you know, particularly the smaller community banks have got a good standing with the regulators. So I think that that's an advantage. I also think you can play geography with regional banks. You can go to parts of the economy or the country that are growing far above trend. And, you know, if you look at places like Texas, you know, are we going to have a recession in Texas? Yeah, maybe it might slow down, but I'm not sure we have a recession. That, you know, the amount of jobs that are creating there, people moving there, companies moving there, I don't think that stops even if the U.S. enters a recession. Same thing probably goes for Tennessee or Florida. So you get to literally laser focus and say, I want to be in those states.
Because corporations and people are moving there. But, you know, I mean, inflation affects everybody. And if we start to see demand destruction because gas gets so expensive that people stop doing things and they pull back in other parts of their lives too because they're expecting inflation to go up, then that's a real concern because consumer spending amounts to so much when it comes to our economy.
Agreed. On a national basis, you're spot on. However, those parts are going to keep growing anyway. People are still going to be moving. Corporations are still going to relocate, and they're still going to, you know, think about cost of living. Right? You live in the greater New York area. What does it cost you to live there? Versus,
well, the average Manhattan is $4,050 a month for a rental. We just learned today.
So, you know, there's a lot of reasons to keep moving. I think that's going to continue. I think that will happen. Also, look, the rate environment. I mean, when have banks actually had the ability to have interest rate margin? I mean, yeah. J.P. Morgan actually on its call guided up for $2 billion more this year of net interest income. So, you know, it matters. It'll matter a lot to a lot of the banks that have really good deposits. Deposits matter. You know, we talked about fintech when we've been on your show before, and they don't have deposits, right? If you can't get the securitizations done, a lot of them, you know, they need banks. And, you know, the ones that don't have deposits or FDIC insurance can't fund. And you've seen that, you know, destruction of companies that lend in that space.
Anton, unfortunately, we've only got about 30, 40 seconds left here. Your fund is up fractionally in the past month, putting it ahead of most of your fund peers in this space. Is there one name that if an investor is thinking about regionals that you think that they should take a look at? It just, again, 30, 35 seconds here. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. I like Veritex in Texas. Mm. They've been growing vastly above trend. I think one of their problems is they were too popular, right? So everybody loved that company in the mid-40s, and as people are degrossing and selling positions, this one raised some money because its growth was so good. This one's, you know, the last in, first out. So I think it suffered because of that. But if you look at 2020 and which banks performed coming out of the beginning of 2020 when those banks got hurt, this was a top performer. I expect they'll be a top performer, so it's one of my top positions.
Well, good to know. It's about a $1.5 billion market cap, actually hitting a 52-week low today with a almost 2.9% dividend yield. Anton Schutz, thank you so much. President, Chief Investment Officer at Mendon Capital Advisors on the phone from Florida. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So shares of Tesla were down 3.25% earlier in the session. They're now now they're actually up about 0.5%. Some news late yesterday about the company's head of AI leaving. But I got to say, the thing we'd love to focus on is not the baby mamas. Look, Tim's like, don't!
I'm just horrified. I'm horrified right now. Just move past it.
We want to talk about his, I'm in love, I'm buying, I'm pursuing Twitter. And then all of a sudden I'm like, no, not so much.
We got a great voice to talk all about it and who wrote all about it in a new column that's out today. Max Chafkin is features editor. Excuse me, that's his old title. Max Chafkin is now Business Week columnist.
Can we do a
for Bloomberg Business Week? Max, it's always awesome to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us. You got a new column out today. No winners in this botched Twitter deal. So shareholders are worse off. Employees are worse off. What about for potential future deals that Musk wants to do?
Yeah, well, even when this happened, there were people out there saying, hey, you know, remember the last time Elon Musk said he was buying a company, you know, when he attempted to take Tesla private and said he had funding secured, there was a giant SEC thing, and it kind of turned out, you know, when he said funding secure, he didn't exactly mean that he had secured the funding. So there are a lot of people saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't take this deal seriously. On the other hand, Elon Musk is, you know, the world's richest person. And I think a lot of the bankers and the lawyers and basically all of the people involved in this went in thinking, maybe there's a chance he's just joking or he'll pull out or he'll change his mind. He's famously, you know, very mercurial. On the other hand, if this goes through, it's going to be one of the biggest buyouts ever. And it's going to be a huge opportunity for us. So I think there was a lot of, in retrospect, people were kind of kidding themselves and maybe, you know, some selfishness and some greed.
Yeah. I mean, people are going to still take his calls, no doubt about it. What is it? I do think about internally what's going on at the company. Because if, first of all, it's been tortured right up to this point. And then if
you're talking Twitter.
Yes, Twitter specifically. So if the deal goes through, though, they're going to get potentially, you know, an owner who maybe doesn't really want the company anymore. Like, I think about them and what's facing their future.
Yeah, I mean, and that's quite a few steps ahead because, of course, there's going to be this gigantic legal battle that's going to play out in Delaware. I mean, the thing that's kind of wild about this is Twitter has always been a sort of bumbling company. You know, the joke about Twitter has been like they, you know, people have been talking about the edit button for, you know, like a decade and nothing's happened. And of course, that was one of Musk's things that he was very interested in doing. And, you know, and so it's one of these companies where you're like, would it be possible to screw this thing up any more than it already is? And I think the answer is we're finding out yes. There are reports coming out that, you know, ad sales, not surprisingly, are struggling. You have a lot of the salespeople leaving because it doesn't feel super good if you're in sales to have the prospective owner bashing you in public. You have, you know, all of this uncertainty kind of on the product side. They basically have stopped doing anything because they figured Musk was coming in. And so there's been just a ton of damage, both damage to the employees who don't have recourse in a court or in a lawsuit. They just sort of have to deal with this. And then, of course, the shareholders who watch the company, you know, go from being worth, you know, a lot more even than Musk's offer, falling. And then, you know, Musk makes this offer. The stock goes up to $52 a share. And then he starts this kind of like drumbeat of attacks. And the stock is way down. Now, some of that has to do with the tech downturn. And actually, when you look at Twitter, it hasn't fallen as far as some tech stocks because you did have the prospect of this offer kind of like anchoring the price. But, you know, having, you know, somebody as influential and smart and well-followed as Elon Musk, you know, just kind of going after you every day probably doesn't help either.
Hey, yeah. Max, just in the last minute we have with you, one of the reasons we want to talk to you is because you did so much reporting on Elon Musk from 20 years ago for your book, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Is the Elon Musk that we see in 2022, who's tweeting to 100.5 million followers, is that the Elon Musk that crossed paths with Peter Thiel in the early days of PayPal? Is this behavior, in other words, typical Elon?
I mean, he's always been a kind of erratic, shoot from the hip guy, and there are anecdotes about him, as you say, from 20 years ago, doing sort of slightly crazy things, and even the creation of SpaceX and Tesla, those were very audacious, maybe even borderline crazy. I mean, the difference is now that this Elon Musk has, you know, more than $100 billion and is one of the most famous people on Earth and can kind of move markets by just tweeting. And so I think you have somebody who is still behaving with the same kind of, you know, elbows out recklessness that, you know, allowed him to become this successful person. But all of a sudden, you know, courts and investors and others are asking him to maybe behave a little bit more responsibly.
And you do wonder, like, in, depending on the outcome of this suit, does it embolden other CEOs to act differently? Just got a few seconds here.
Yeah, and I think that's the real danger, because if Musk is able to just walk away from this based on what feels like a flimsy pretext, you know, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't have other CEOs kind of trying the same thing.
Unbelievable. Great story. Max Chafkin, features editor. He's been features editor,
columnist.
Now Business Week columnist, author. He does it all. He does it all.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. No, no, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please. I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me. I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, coming up on just about 11 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Thursday trade. Very different from what we saw earlier on. Some economic news, but really in particular, some bank news that I think kind of maybe freaked out some investors. We saw some pressure and selling in both J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley has really bounced back, though, Tim, from the lows of the day.
Still a decliner, though, Carol.
Just barely.
Barely, yeah. We're keeping a good eye on it. Let's get into it with Walter Todd, the president and chief investment officer at Greenwood Capital Associates. Greenwood Capital is a registered investment advisor. They've got about $1.4 billion in assets under management. Walter joining us this afternoon from Greenwood, South Carolina. Walter, how are you?
Doing good. Hope you guys are well.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well. Help us make sense of today's trade. The S&P 500 down 0.4% right now. We saw stocks move off their lows when we heard comments from Waller earlier today that it was more likely 75 basis points rather than 100 basis points. But still, they opened much lower, more than 2% to the downside for the S&P 500. What's going on here?
Yeah, pretty wild day for sure. And when you look at kind of different components of the market, you look at commodities, I mean, oil touched, I think, 92 today. It's back flat. The dollar blew out to, you know, over 109 on the DXY and is still up significantly, but has come way off that level. So, yeah, kind of a lot of cross currents here, and I think there's, you know, still some digestion of that CPI report. And then, you know, the news coming out, or the headline that came out with the JP Morgan report that they're going to, you know, temporarily pause buybacks, I think that really kind of shocked the market, because honestly, the Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan reports were somewhat similar, and the messaging from the CEOs was very similar. It's almost like they got in a room and decided what to say, because they're all very similar, more upbeat than you would think given the reaction in the stocks. But the difference was that that buyback halt by JP Morgan, I think, just, you know, that kind of set a negative tone for the day.
Are you seeing any signs technically that say maybe we are nearing a bottom, certainly on the equity side of things? And I think about when you were on with us, Walter, back in February, you pointed out at the time that the S&P was down, I think, at that point, just about 10% from its highs, but the average stock was down 20% or more, right? This is, I love when we kind of start to dig deeper into the layers of the market to get an idea of kind of really what's going on. What are you seeing today, maybe what it tells you about where we go from here?
Yeah, it's a great point. And when you look at kind of the first quarter, if you will, coming out of that March, we had that huge rally into the end of the first quarter, and then we, you know, took another leg lower here in the second quarter, particularly in June. But what you saw when the S&P made a new low in June is that the number of absolute new lows in the market actually decreased a little bit. So the breadth looked a little bit better. Having said that, today doesn't look great. But in general, I would say over the past month, you started to see the breadth a little bit better, even though the overall index continues to trade lower. So to answer your question, you know, I think this 3675 level, 3700 levels, you know, pretty important. It's, you know, above the lows that we reached last month. If we can hold that, perhaps we can, you know, kind of set a foundation to move higher. A lot of negativity heading into earnings. So we'll see how, you know, stocks react to these numbers as they come out.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those numbers and what we expect from companies right now. What are you going to be looking for specifically to see if companies are actually saying, hey, wait a second, the current economic environment is just as bad as people think?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's really I think you're going to have to really, you know, you have to do this every quarter, but I think really this quarter you're really going to have to focus in on, you know, the calls and the commentary, not so much the press release of the quarter, because I don't know that that's going to tell you that much. you know, so for example, listening to the J.P. Morgan call today, again, you know, the commentary was more upbeat than if you just you kind of read the press release and the headlines that came out with the earnings report. And then importantly, you know, how do the stocks react to the, in any type of guidance that's given? You know, J.P. Morgan's negative today, but, you know, a week from now, is it higher than it was, you know, before the earnings? Those type of actions in the stock are really going to be more telling than anything, you know, in the press release on the quarter. It's just listening to management and what they're saying.
Yeah, it's interesting. Although, you know, he did set aside J.P. Morgan, what, $428 million in those net reserves as he gets ready for a potential downturn. I mean, this is what those big money center banks, right, have to do, right? There's, you know, the oversight. Yeah. So they've got to make sure that they are prepared just in case.
Well, I'm sure you heard Jamie Dimon kind of dropkick the regulators on the call with saying that this, you know, the stress tests were capricious and arbitrary and not a good way to run a financial system. So, you know, he's not too happy with having to raise that capital, but of course they're doing it. They're doing it quickly.
Yeah, they did get a bailout during the crisis, just to remind everybody.
Well, that's true. So anyway, yeah. I think, you know, that those type of anecdotes that you get on the call, again, about the current environment versus the quarter just reported are really going to be the most important things to focus on.
How much pessimism is reflected in stocks right now? That is, how much of potential earnings revisions to the downside is reflected in the U.S. market right now? Because if it sounds like you're saying, you know, if we could hold at 3675, 3700, then the worst could be behind us.
Yeah, I think we could set the stage coming out of earnings for a rally. Now, whether that 3600, 3700 is the bottom, anybody's guess, but in terms of setting the stage for a kind of a durable move back up towards, let's say, 4,000, I think that could be done depending on these stock reactions. Micron reacted initially very poorly to a very big guidance drawdown, but has since traded about 15% higher from before the earnings report. So that's a good sign of stocks reacting more positively to negative news. And then we had some positive news out of Taiwan Semi last night, for example. So there are some positive stories as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I keep going to this story that's on the Bloomberg by our John Authors. It's an opinion column, and he's been looking at the warp function on the Bloomberg, the world interest rate probabilities function. And, you know, getting into what we're seeing, and that it does seem to indicate that once we get through this rate tightening cycle, that the shift to a belief in a rapid exit from tight monetary policy, that is still intact. Is it too soon, Walter, in your view, to start thinking about the Fed cutting rates and that, you know, loosening round of policy?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I mean, the market's starting to price in a, you know, a albeit low percentage probability of a rate cut by March of next year.
Mm-hmm.
So the market is definitely looking at that as they pull forward these hikes very aggressively. But I would just point you to one thing to look at. Look at the one-year break-even on the Bloomberg. It's gone from 6.5% roughly to 3.5% in about 3 months.
Wow.
So everybody's scrambling for the Fed to tighten 100 basis points and go another 75. And again, as I said this morning, they're looking in the rearview mirror, unfortunately, and not out of the windshield. And there's a reason they make the windshield a heck of a lot bigger than the rearview mirror. Is you need to drive looking out of the front.
That's exactly what Authors points out, too. He says, look at those inflation break-evens and what they're saying. So the risk of the Fed overdoing it and pushing us into a recession, yes, I almost feel like that's a given, but a recession that's maybe more problematic and not easy to get out of, is that a risk?
Yeah, it is. And I think you know, the inverted yield curve is telling you that. It's more inverted than it was in the financial crisis, the twos to tens right now. So the market's kind of screaming at the Fed, you know, hold on a minute. We'll see if they listen.
Yeah, the 3 month and 10 year also, which is a better, right, than the two and the 10 even, you know, in terms of a recession indicator. Walter Todd, thank you so much. Great to catch up with you. President and Chief Investment Officer at Greenwood Capital Associates, joining us on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina. Always good to get his thoughts on what we're seeing. And so he's keeping an eye on that 3,700 level on the S&P. We're at 3,792. And as he said, if we can hold that, that maybe we can move higher. Maybe we form another bottom or a new base, if you will, for the S&P generally. What?
We'll see.
We'll see.
We got data coming tomorrow.
I'm data dependent. I don't know about you.
You what?
I'm
data dependent. That's funny. We got data, speaking of that, data tomorrow. And then, of course, we got like earnings really kicking off next week and the week after.
Yeah, retail sales tomorrow and then consumer sentiment. University of Michigan, we'll be watching that and the expectations.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.